Hi, I'm Emma Vigeland, and this is Ring of Fire. Before we roll into this week's podcast, we wanted to let our listeners know that Sam had some technical difficulties with his audio this week. As most of you know, due to COVID, we've been recording the show under tough, irregular circumstances, so this won't be the case forever. And unfortunately, this week it finally caught up to us when Sam and Digby experienced audio issues, and we just decided it was impossible to air. So, however, we do have a great interview to air this week with the great Dave Zirin, who is a frequent guest on the show and the premier progressive sports analyst and author out there. He writes for The Nation. I sat down with Dave earlier this week to discuss the mass exploitation of college athletes by the NCAA. So let's get into the show. Hey everyone, I'm here with Dave Zirin, who is the sports editor over at The Nation magazine and also an author. You recently wrote a book about Jim Brown, is that right, Dave?
That is correct. And I got another book coming out this fall called The Kaepernick Effect.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm excited to read that because I really loved your piece in The Nation. His piece is entitled Welcome to the Real March Madness, and you talk about the exploitation of college athletes in the NCAA, which has been really an issue that I care a lot about as a sports fan. I'm a big football fan, and I think it's especially glaring when it comes to college football, with just the bombacity of these programs, with how much revenue they bring in, how integral they are to the culture in parts of this country. But specifically, I mean, you talk about March Madness, and I want to get into that as well. The pandemic just ripped off the veneer, really, of college athletics being a student athlete experience. Can we talk about that more broadly, and just how the NCAA has tried to, and I believe failed, walk this tightrope of, oh yeah, we're compelling these student athletes to participate in this industry that makes us a lot of money, but yeah, they're still just student athletes, not professional athletes.
Absolutely. I mean, these are professional athletes, of course, in any way but name, in the revenue producing sports of football and basketball. I mean, we're talking about coaches like Nick Saban at Alabama, who make upwards of $10 million a year. Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, who's in that ballpark as well. And just thousands upon thousands of student athletes who are workers in everything but name. I mean, they live in this constitutional carve-out zone where they have no rights, no collective bargaining, no union, no forum with which to express themselves, and yet they're expected to show up and work so these coaches can make that money, so these stadiums can get built, so boosters are happy. I mean, they have become a tentpole of the modern 21st century neoliberal campus. And some of these schools now are just hosting grounds for sporting events where they just happen to have classes in between games. That's the importance with which sports has elevated itself on the modern campus. And, you know, it's also worth keeping in mind that we're the only country that does this. We're the only country that says, hey, the minor leagues for our big professional sports teams, they're going to run through the college system. You know, we're the only ones who do this, and it's hyper exploitative. And I could go on about it for hours and hours. I'll let you ask me another question. It's just to say that in the time of COVID, we've seen any kind of veneer in front of this, that these are quote unquote student athletes, a term, by the way, that was made up by the NCAA in a legal case to so they wouldn't have to pay a wrongful death suit to the wife of a guy who died on a football field. That's where the phrase student athlete comes from, to create that constitutional carve out zone. And but COVID has just ripped the veneer off of it entirely. And now we have a situation where the athletes are going to play in this very unsafe circumstance for March Madness, precisely because the economic survival of the NCAA depends on it. There are no more noble reasons than that.
Yeah, and the NCAA has had a really difficult time not just outright stating that fact, right? Okay, so it's not safe back in the fall for students to come to campus, but it is safe for us to have our college football programs, and we won't have the testing capacity of the NFL and then, of course, college basketball in the winter. So you touch on March Madness. I wanted to quickly just build upon what you said about the efforts to unionize and the fact that they haven't been able to yet. You talk about this in your piece, but in 2015, Northwestern student athletes did attempt to form a union. People have to realize a lot of these kids are often come from poorer backgrounds. A lot of times they're black, and that's a whole part of the exploitation, especially in the South too, and the culture of that. And they're teenagers or close to it. And so they're not really thinking about collective bargaining. What's being held mm-hmm. over their head is, you have a future in the NFL. You have a future in the NBA. So just endure these. In case of the college basketball, endure this 1 year. If you're a really high up there prospect, or in the NFL, or what is it, 3 years for college? Yeah, endure this, and then maybe you get a chance at a big payday. Oh no, you blow out your ACL, you'll never get paid, and your family's etc. So I'm going on and on myself, but why did that Northwestern unionization effort fall apart? Did it include some of the things I said about this, just these kids being really young? And how is the door left open a little bit in the future for future unionization efforts of college athletes?
Sure. I mean, the Northwestern effort didn't work largely because, you know, our system of labor and recognizing unions in this country moves at just a glacial pace. So you have these incredibly motivated Northwestern, quote unquote, student athletes who were who wanted to unionize. And they were doing so even over the objections of their football coach, who was making at the time $3 to $4 million a year, over the objections of the trustees, over the objections of all kinds of boosters and financial backers of the program. And yet there's a problem with that, in that, you know, if you're an upperclassman, eventually you graduate and you're not there to see it through. Some of us who did student activism in college might have some memories of what it's like to build a movement on campus and see it fall apart when we leave. I thought this dynamic hewed actually very closely to that, in terms of, I've had a lot of discussions with Kane Coulter and some of the other Northwestern players. Kane Coulter, the quarterback on the team, came up with the idea of doing a unionization effort after being part of a labor law class on Northwestern University's campus. And I always found that to be particularly ironic, because you're calling these athletes student athletes. You're saying they're not employees. You're saying they get an education. And here's somebody in Kane Coulter and a couple other players who were in this class who actually were inspired by their education to start thinking union. And that was somehow like an absolute shock. It's like, yeah, you can go learn, but God forbid you apply what you just learned in class. That's why on many schools, particularly the big state schools, they are really tough on the players in terms of the kind of classes they can take, because, you know, they don't want them taking classes that might lead them to question the setup, which is built, as you said, on deep racial hierarchies, deep class hierarchies. And so they start challenging the system itself. That is not something that the people who run these programs want. Now, they went before the National Labor Relations Board, the Northwestern student athletes, the Northwestern team. And it's like there's a local board and a national board. The local board said, yes, you are right. You are paid in terms of your scholarship. So you basically are already a worker. You know, so you have the right to push for more. You have the right to collectively bargain. It was a big victory.
Similar to, just to interject quickly, say you worked at the bookstore, at the college bookstore when you were in college, in order to help pay your tuition, something like that, or to supplement the scholarship that you were getting, et cetera.
Yeah. Except I guess I'm just speaking for my humble college, but at least there, when we did work study, we also got something like $8 an hour.
Right. No, well, exactly. No. It's even worse than that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, players now get a small stipend. And a lot of the only reason they do that is because of the Northwestern players and other student athletes and other people, you know, outside the world of college athletics who have raised this issue. And any progress we've seen has come from the NCAA just kicking and screaming and clawing to not have that progress. But then they went to the National Labor Relations Board, and the National Labor Relations Board, they gave a ruling that's tough to untangle. But basically, they said, yeah, you can't form a union. You know, you're not workers. But however, they punted it forward and said, but the dynamics are as such that if student athletes in the future want to organize, we'll be willing to hear that. So they didn't close the door on it. They left it open, but it wasn't nearly the rebuke of the NCAA that the local NLRB put forward.
Right. So we'll get back to that because it was encouraging news. Well, not last year, in 2019, out of California, that on that front in terms of student athletes being able to be compensated. But let's return back to the focus of your piece, which is March Madness and how these athletes are being treated in the pandemic, because March Madness is where the NCAA gets a very high proportion of their revenue. Obviously, many people do March Madness pools. It's a whole culture around it. Among the many precautions or protocols that these players are having to do, like stay in hotels, not see anybody, have all their meals served to them, right? They have to wear contact tracing, electronic surveillance all the time. So this happens in the NFL. I believe this happened in the NBA too, especially in the bubble. And this is happening in all the other sports. I don't even know if the NHL can afford to do it, but some of the other sports are doing this too. That's fine. These guys are getting paid. These athletes who are undergoing all of these huge hurdles and health risks, they aren't getting paid because the prospect, again, professional success, just a small chance at it in the major leagues, is being dangled over their head. So can you talk about that and what's happening with March Madness this year?
Sure. One figure I saw said that the NCAA's yearly operating revenue, 89% of it comes from the TV deal around March Madness. So for the NCAA, this is about putting product on your television set. That's what they're all about. And for them, the fans are just scenery. But they want that scenery. So they've put forward this idea that the stadiums can be 25% full. And when I say stadiums, I mean stadiums, because the Final Four for the men's is in Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. It seats 70,000 people. That's roughly 18,000 people who are going to gather to watch that, which just seems like baldly irresponsible.
And I will say, I've been there. I went to the Super Bowl there when my Giants won in the 2011-2012 season. Been to Lucas Oil. It is packed tight, those seats. Pretty close together, all on top of each other, even if it's just 25% full.
Wow, that was a fantastic Super Bowl to go to.
It was a big deal for me.
Especially for a Giants fan. but to get back on subject here. It's okay. I'm from New York, so I'll talk about that all day. But to go back to these guys, the problem is that you mentioned the NBA bubble. Every concern that the NBA players had about HIPAA, you know, their privacy, how they would be dealt with by the league, all of that was collectively bargained through their union. So yeah, the bubble wasn't perfect, but it was figured out collectively with people representing the interests of the players, aka the workers themselves. These college basketball players, they got none of that. So instead, they're just sucked into, and this I talk about this in the article, this broader surveillance culture that exists in the NCAA. I mean, these players, they have such little freedom of movement on a campus, such little freedom of what classes they can take, even sometimes what they put on social media, certainly. A lot of teams have rules that you can't post or your posts have to be approved. Even just like the most basic freedom about that I associate with college, about like going to parties and what parties you can go to or not go to, you know, and their assistant coaches, it's very routine that they show up at your classes to poke their head in and make sure that you're sitting in there. So it's this constant swirling prospect of being treated, you know, like you're a piece of equipment, except a piece of equipment that's somehow sentient that you have to look after to make sure the equipment's in the right place at the right time. So I think like this idea of now they're wearing the contact tracers, they're having to eat alone or in their hotel rooms. It's another step towards hyper surveillance of these young people. And it's, to me, it's just, it's morally untenable. But I've been saying that for a lot of years. So we'll see how long it takes for the dam to break, but break it will.
Yes, I hope so as well. And I just want to give people a sense of the scale of these, because I jotted these down before the interview. Just college football programs in itself, and the Big Ten, Michigan, Penn State, Ohio State, between $100 to $125 million in revenue. SEC, you know, Georgia, Alabama, they're all in that range too. Texas in the Big 12, I didn't realize it makes the most, $156 yeah. million dollars in revenue. Players get nothing. Nothing. And then it's held over their head, oh, this is an education for you. They're not there to get an education. They're there to make money. And oftentimes, yes, they're slotted into classes so they don't get an education. And all of this, and they spend all their time because their professional future success is based on what they're putting their energy into in the weight room, studying film, whatever it is. And so it's this exploitation.
You don't want to be labeled a troublemaker either.
Right, right. And so can you touch on a little bit, because I think the racial element is so important, especially in college football. Basketball is just more progressive of a culture of a sport in general, but college football is so deeply embedded with racism and the history of slavery. So can you touch on the NCAA as a part of that overall system in terms of how they treat Black players and just Black bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're talking about healthcare, if you're talking that they can receive after they leave the school, if you're talking about opportunity, economic opportunity, scholastic opportunity, if you don't make the NFL, I mean, the amount of horror stories that come out of people who've played big time college football, I mean, they're legion. And they're all over the place. And it's because the system itself doesn't care for these young people. And the fact that they're disproportionately Black makes it easier to not care for them. But the way I've always analyzed it myself is that when you talk about these college football players, they are some of the most powerless, but also some of the most powerful workers in the United States. Powerless for all the reasons we've talked about. No union, no collective bargaining. They can get, you know, they could have a 4-year scholarship, but they could get cut at any time. And then, you know, they have to leave school. So really treated like, you know, like partly like chattel. But then they're also powerful, because if they choose not to play, this entire system falls apart. And I'm not just talking about the football program. I'm talking about the university system. I mean, you mentioned the money before. I would just say it's not just about the revenues that the athletic department makes directly through athletics. It's also through the way it brands the school in a way that's, you know, that allows them to go out for research money, goes out for donors. I mean, the University of Texas a couple years ago, you mentioned their prowess. They sent their student athletes to this like month-long tour in China, and they were praising it as if to say, look at this amazing, you know, experience it will be for these young people. But all it was really about was about selling Texas gear for the Chinese market. And the students themselves had first of all, they missed a ton of school, which really pissed off some professors I knew, like, were just, you know, really upset about that. And then the other thing about it was they were incredibly surveilled while they were there, not by the Chinese government, but by the University of Texas. So there were limitations as to what they could then in fact do. So it's that aspect of it is so important, but their power is so much. I always go back to University of Missouri in 2015. You know, that was the year before Colin Kaepernick took a knee, but it was after Ferguson. The University of Missouri is within, of course, close driving distance of Ferguson, Missouri. And the Black players decided that they were not going to play, and they were joined by their white teammates and then by the almost all white coaching staff. And it was all done in solidarity with what was a serious mass student movement on campus against racism. And so it started with the students, Black students on campus, and then it ricocheted onto the football team themselves, and they said they wouldn't play. And all of a sudden, this guy who was the president of the entire University of Missouri system, Tim Wolf, I believe his name was, he has to resign because it was going to cost the school $1 million a week. So that's the power.
I remember that.
The question is, when are they going to flex it? Because if they do, it brings down so much, because so much is actually dependent on the ability of these teams to brand the broader campus.
It's just so hard to ask kids at that age to make choice.
Absolutely.
When they are like, I have to do everything right under this surveillance state, and then potentially I can make millions of dollars for my family if I grow. I mean, there's a high propensity of poverty in these student athletes. Take care of my extended family for years and years, et cetera. So I hear what you're saying. It's just, I think it's about bringing awareness to it. I mean, like, you know, we could have had a lot of college athletes sit out. You know, someone like Trevor Lawrence could have taken the stand and said, I'm not playing. He had nothing. He was going to be the first overall pick no matter what. Chose to play anyway. So, I mean.
The opposite. Rallied people to insist that players get to take the field.
Yeah, that's I'm not really a fan after that, to be honest.
No, I'm not either, because he was one of the players, and it was significant because Trevor Lawrence, of course, is white. That was, you know, rallying his team and speaking out, you know, on behalf of Black lives after the murder of George Floyd. And you started to see very interesting things then percolate in this world of college football. I mean, it was amazing that there were marches of the football team that were joined by coaches at the University of Alabama and at the University of Mississippi. I mean, if you had told somebody that 50 years ago, that majority Black teams at Alabama and Mississippi would be marching for civil rights and social justice and call for Confederate monuments to be torn down, I mean, people's jaws would have hit the floor. I said 50 years ago, try 5 years ago.
Yeah, Nick Saban arm in arm with Black players marching. I mean, come on.
There was a lot of bullshit sprinkled on. But the thing about it that was so important, though, is it shows that the powers that be also understand that if players are angry, things can change very, very quickly.
Last question, because we can end on a little bit of a positive note here. Gavin Newsom, I think his popularity recently due to his dealings with COVID and hypocrisy there has dipped below 50%. But a good thing he did back in 2019 is he signed the Fair Pay to Play Act, which means in 2023, I believe, college players are going to be compensated. Can you talk about what that means for schools like UCLA, USC, whatever, Cal, and if that's going to spread nationally? Like, say it's going to be a big recruitment tool for those schools, and players are going to go, I can go here. And if you see any other similar movements in other states throughout the country.
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting is that when Newsom started to push that, one of his first backers was actually Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. Now, Ron DeSantis is to the right of right wing. I mean, he's a CPAC staple. But there's something about this issue which has united birds of a different feather on this. Maybe it's the rank exploitation. Maybe it's the absence of the free market in allowing players to determine their own worth. But it's brought people together. And my understanding is that the NCAA is now making moves to nationalize this policy out of California, because after Newsom, DeSantis, and others said, hey, this is a good idea, it was the equivalent. One journalist described this to me about they've put a legislative gun to the head of the NCAA. That's how they described it. Because then you started to have congressmen on Capitol Hill. Congresspeople on Capitol Hill start to talk about it, and senators, and talk about what legislation they could put together to complement this. And what the NCAA wants to do above all else is have this happen on their own terms. They want to be in control of the process. They understand that the process is slipping away from them, but the NCAA spends millions of dollars on having lawyers on perpetual retainer. And all of that is to guard the golden goose. All of that is to make sure that this mechanism that they've set up, which is basically when you take away all of the confetti, is a mechanism for the organized theft of Black wealth. Once that has been exposed and dealt with, the NCAA then has to figure out, well, where's our role to survive in the years and decades ahead?
Dave Zirin, the sports editor at The Nation, His piece is called Welcome to the Real March Madness, and author of at least 10 books surrounding, I would say, progressive sports coverage. I really enjoyed this interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks, Em. I'm a big fan of both you and the show, so thank you.
Well, I'm a big fan of your work. Appreciate it. That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Thank you for supporting this show. And again, we apologize for the technical difficulties. Don't forget that you can become a member of this show by heading over to rofpodcast.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out Sam and I on our daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for our daily live stream, covering all the biggest news stories of the day. For Sam Seder, I'm Emma Vigeland, and this has been Ring of Fire. Jesus Christ, pray nothing.